we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi on Shireen's murder.
Israel is at war with journalism. Following the horrific killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, which sent reverberations around the world, it is vital we examine some of the less obvious ways in which the temporary Zionist entity fights against exposure of the facts. Shireen Abu Akleh is a name which will echo through the ages, but her name is merely the latest in a long list of clearly identified journalists whose lives were cut short by the Israeli regime. Names like Yasser Murtaja, Ahmed Abu Hussein, Basil Faraj, Fadel Shana, Imad Abu Zahra, Issam Tilawi, James Miller, Khalid Riyad Hamad, Mahmoud Al-Kumi, and Nazih Darwaza should also be remembered. They all wore clothing identifying themselves as press, and all were killed by the temporary entity. The Palestinian Journalists Union says 55 journalists have been killed by Zionists since the year 2000. Since 2018, at least 144 Palestinian journalists have been wounded by Zionist forces across the Gaza Strip, West Bank and East Jerusalem, hurt by live fire and rubber bullets, as well as stun grenades, tear gas, beatings with batons, according to Reporters Without Borders. Another way in which the Israeli regime expresses its disdain for the reporting of truth is through its insistence on prosecuting Palestinian journalists on the charge of incitement. Between 2015 and 2018, over 500 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli regime for the crime of incitement for things they posted online. Many were journalists and some were children. Currently, there are more than 15 Palestinian journalists languishing in occupation jails for so-called incitement. Some are being held under administrative detention. The Israeli NSO group has exported its Pegasus spyware around the world, hacking into phones of thousands of activists and journalists in many different countries. It was claimed by the organization that it had no access to the information its spyware was hacking for other regimes. However, that would fail to explain how NSO advisory board member Sherry Blair was able to inform the ex-wife of Dubai's ruler that she was a target of her former husband. If the NSO group does not have access to this information, how could Sherry Blair possibly know? The shocking Zionist police attack on the funeral of Shireen Abu Akleh reminds us that none of this behavior is new to Zionist occupation forces. Apartheid troops shot dead Shawkat Khalil Awad at the funeral of Muhammad al-Alama, a child they shot dead the night before in 2021. And there have been many other examples of Palestinian funerals coming under violent assault. So here we have a pariah regime, rejected by much of the world, which engages in constant covert and overt war against any journalist seeking to reveal the truth about its actions. Long live the martyr, Shireen Abu Akleh. Long live adversarial journalism.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Mona Kandil. Mona is a Ramallah correspondent for Press TV. Being a journalist in occupied Palestine is not easy, and many times Mona's had to remove her Press TV logo from her mic while covering demonstrations and clashes in Al-Quds. The most difficult is the protests ending up with confrontations between Israeli forces and Palestinian protesters. The challenge for her, then, is to cover a story and return home safe and sound. Mona was born in Lebanon and grew up in Saida City. She also lived in Algeria and Syria before returning to Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Mona joins us today from Ramallah. Welcome to the show. Mona, I wonder if we could get you up on the screen, if we could perhaps start with you, if I may. I mean, the situation in the West Bank since Shireen's murder, I mean, we've seen, you know, many outrages in recent weeks. I wonder if you could give us a feel about the situation and what the atmosphere is actually like there right now.
Well, we have to say that Israeli aggression, Israeli violence against the Palestinians have been escalating even, let's say, with the start of the holy month of Ramadan and mainly on Fridays of the holy month of Ramadan. However, when Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aqli was murdered by Israeli soldiers in cold blood in Jenin, as everyone watched her killing in Jenin last week. Since then, and the Israeli soldiers had been really outraged. On the one hand, they killed a Palestinian journalist on cold blood, and on the other hand, they don't want for the Palestinians to confront the Israelis, to express their anger, to demand for bringing the Israeli soldiers who were behind the killing of Shireen Abu Aqli and to prosecute them. This is very weird for the whole world. First of all, Israeli soldiers in Jenin killed Shireen Abu Aqli while she was wearing her flak jacket. It was clearly written on its breast. And she was also putting her helmet as well. Before her death, another Palestinian journalist, Ali Samoudi, was shot and wounded. And he tried to warn the other journalists there, Shireen Abu Aqli, and another female journalist, Shada, in order to take care. But however, they couldn't. They tried to shelter themselves to return back to a wall that was next to a tree. They were close to the Israeli soldiers, but at the same time, there were no Palestinian protesters, no Palestinian fighters, no Palestinian citizens around them. So there were only a group of journalists, Palestinian cameramen, trying to shoot the Israeli Israeli military incursion to Jenin, and then there were the Israeli soldiers opening their fire towards those Palestinian journalists, Israeli soldiers, of course. Everyone also saw when a Palestinian man tried to pull the body of Shireen Abu Aqli. Israeli soldiers didn't stop. They continued to fire towards those Palestinian journalists. So it's a murder. It's an assassination. We're not saying the Israeli soldiers' acts and aggression and crimes are saying that it's an assassination of Shireen Abu Aqli. The escalation continued because it was a shock, not only for Palestinian journalists. We have to mention that Shireen Abu Aqli is a well-known Palestinian journalist because she works with an Arab channel that, let's say, the Arab people here in Palestine follow, of course, the Arab channels, not the English channels, let's say. And she was working for Al Jazeera for over 20 years. She covered the Israeli, the Intifada. She covered the Israeli raid to Jenin almost 20 years ago. So many of them considered that by killing Shireen Abu Aqli, the Israeli forces had killed a sister of every Palestinian, also killed a friend of their childhood. This is why it was very difficult on them. And this continued to anger the Israeli military, of course.
Yeah. I mean, David, the scenes from Jenin, I mean, absolutely shocking. And, you know, the monstrous attack on the mourners at Shireen's funeral. I don't think I've seen anything quite like that. I mean, what's your take on the situation?
Well, I mean, it looks like that the Israelis simply cannot tolerate any sign of resistance. Mm. So one of the things they objected to, it appears, in the funeral, was the appearance of Palestinian flags. And they had said in advance, you can't have Palestinian flags, you can't have chanting. And then, of course, when they attacked the funeral, they said later, well, it was because there were stones being thrown and there were rioters, and we attacked the rioters. Well, no, the people were the pallbearers they attacked. They weren't rioting, they weren't throwing stones. The footage clearly shows that. What they can't stand is any sign of resistance, of a proud, resistant people. And the Palestinian flags is one of those signs. And you see footage across the West Bank of them trying to remove Palestinian flags from demonstrators, etc., because they can't bear the sign of resistance. I think it betrays, though, a certain insecurity amongst Zionist forces themselves, the police, the military, and also the settlers. A certain insecurity which has been expressed even by the defense minister, Benny Gantz, the other day when he said, you know, it's not very clear that we can still be here in a few years' time. We might have to constrict the state of Israel to a small portion in the middle around about Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. So they are worried, and that's what leads to the ultra-violent expressions against Shireen Abu Aqli's funeral and indeed other incidents.
Mona, How on earth do journalists operate in such an oppressive environment as that?
Well, let's say the most important thing is that to tell the truth, to cover the Israeli crimes, but also to try to return home safe and sound. And this is not difficult and not easy for Palestinians, of course, because the Israeli soldiers do not differentiate between Palestinian journalists or Palestinian protesters. All of them are considered Palestinians. It's not the first incident when a Palestinian journalist is killed. 50 Palestinian journalists have been shot dead by the Israeli forces since 2000 up till the moment. A number of Palestinian journalists have been detained by the Israeli forces. Also, expressing your thoughts over social media, of course, is prohibited. You would be arrested and questioned by the Israeli soldiers anytime. Palestinian journalists continue to face the same destiny of the normal people here. When we covered the protests and demonstrations, numerous times we had been attacked by the Israeli soldiers, suffer suffocation due to inhaling the tear gas. Me, myself, I had to stay in hospital for almost 24 hours because of the heavy tear gas that was fired by Israeli soldiers in the last protest almost 3 years ago. It was a different of gas that caused not only suffocation, but long side effects. So the Palestinian journalists try their utmost in order to cover what's going on, but at the same time, make sure that we are safe. However, the Israeli soldiers do not differentiate between the journalists and the protesters. In addition to this, working with any channel that the Israelis consider their enemy, it's not only Press TV, we have to say this, any international channel or international TV would be considered by the Israeli regime as their enemy. They don't want for the journalists to expose their crimes, to tell the world what's really going on. They want to kill the people, arrest people, demolish Palestinians' homes, annex the lands and seize more lands, of course, expand illegal settlements. And at the same time, they don't want for anyone to expose their crimes or to tell the world and the international community, let's say, what's going on. They continue to act as a state above the law, knowing that at the end of the day, there would be no accountability. Their soldiers, would be would have the impunity, and no one would drag them to the international criminal court.
We're going to have to just move on to the next item now, Mona, if that's OK. How the influence which is being put upon the media to give a distorted position in relation to the reporting and indeed what's actually happening on the ground in Palestine.
Western media try their best not to tell the truth about Palestine. The double standard on Palestine and Ukraine has been pointed out by many. The same is said about the reluctance to use active words like killed, executed, or murdered for the killing of the Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Al Jazeera journalists, colleagues of Shireen Abu Akleh, expressed outrage at the murderous activities of Zionist forces. Two argued that the network should no longer allow apologists for Israel to appear on the channel. Algerian journalist Khadija Ben Genna, with 2 million Twitter followers, called on Al Jazeera to boycott Israeli guests. Ahmed Mansour, host at Al Jazeera Media Network, with 1.3 million Twitter followers, added his voice, demanding that Al Jazeera Arabic stop hosting the Israeli killers on its screens or whoever represents them. This would certainly have an impact on media coverage of the conflict, especially if it was not confined to Al Jazeera's Arabic service. It's well known that Zionist propagandists are able to exert significant influence on media agendas. But who are the propagandists? And would their removal be enough to cleanse the media of propaganda for murder and war crimes? The propaganda or Hasbara apparatus of the Zionist state centrally involves the so-called IDF spokespersons unit, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and until recently, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, all coordinated by the Public Diplomacy Directorate in the Prime Minister's office. In early 2022, this effort was relaunched with a renewed commitment to funding a vast covert network of proxies and front groups. Some of this is coordinated via something called the Coalition of Hasbara Volunteers, including groups based all over the world, including many explicitly Zionist groups, as well as PR fronts like BICOM, Stand With Us, or We Believe in Israel in the UK, and CAMERA, or Honest Reporting, in the US. Banning Zionist Hasbara officials and their PR and lobby front groups would help more of the truth to emerge from Palestine. But we would still have to deal with the problem of direct Zionist influence in the media. There are many thousands of journalists working in Western news organizations who are partisans of Zionism, many of them having current or former membership of Zionist organizations or Israel lobby groups. In the UK, for example, Alex Brummer is the city editor for the Daily Mail, as well as being the chair of the State of Israel-funded Abraham Initiatives. Jonathan Friedland is a senior columnist at The Guardian and was a member for the Zionist youth group Habonim Dror, as was BBC presenter Emma Barnett. There are hundreds more. The task ahead is to steadily degrade the number of Zionist assets working in the Western media, allowing independent, indeed liberation journalism, more of a chance.
David, what do you make of the suggestion that, you know, kind of removes Zionists, you know, from the news? Is that a kind of a practical proposition?
Well, it sort of sounds unfeasible and unreasonable. But if you think about the flip side of this, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years, when there are military conflicts, Western governments, including those of Israel and the US and the UK, have managed to almost entirely exclude those who support armed violence against the West. Terrorists, they're called. So it's not impractical for Western media to remove Zionists from spokespersons from the news. It just requires the political consensus and pressure to do so. So it's not an impossible thing to do. But it would be something which would be very difficult in the current political circumstances. The political circumstances have to change in order to do that. But I think we need to think of this as something which is part of a process of reconceptualizing what's happening in Palestine and trying to push back so that it's possible for the truth to be told.
I mean, in the previous clip, we heard about the NSO group and they're claiming that they can't get access to this sort of Pegasus information. But how is it then, do you think? I mean, maybe you could comment on that. I know it sort of mentioned it in the package there about Sherry Blair reaching out to the wife of the leader in Dubai. I mean, what do you make? It's a bit odd, isn't it? I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, can you say a little bit about that?
Well, we have quite a number of different high-tech firms. The NSO group is only one of them. It's the most well-known because there's been the most cases about it, which come directly or indirectly from the Israeli intelligence organizations. So they are organizations which effectively have some kind of intelligence backdoor and are used as instruments of foreign policy by, for example, the Israeli state. So that this is a mechanism by which effectively a foreign intelligence agency can monitor journalists, activists all around the world and use that to their own advantage. In the case of Sherry Blair, it's odd, isn't it? I mean, the owners of this company say, we don't know what people are using our software for. We only give it to certain governments. We don't know what they're using it for. But yet, nevertheless, Sherry Blair, who had this connection with the NSO group, was able to reveal to this former royal that she was being surveilled by her ex-husband. So there's something very, very dodgy about that, isn't there? Mm. And there needs to be much more investigation of organisations like the NSO group and other similar organisations.
Yeah. Mona, perhaps we get Mona back on the screen again. I wonder whether you could say a little bit about, I mean, what the mechanisms that are used to ensure that Palestinian views are not heard by a global audience, you know, the truth about Palestine?
Well, it's all Palestinian journalists here do their utmost, but maybe the Israeli authorities, Israeli occupation authorities, try their utmost to tell the word that what they do would be a reaction on the Palestinian so-called terrorists. But what's going on really here in the occupied territories is that it's really a crimes and aggression being committed by the Israeli forces. It's not about only occupying a territory and that leaving them alone to live in that territory. No, Israeli aggression and violence, Israeli crimes continue to be committed. That's why Palestinian journalists are doing their utmost to tell the world what's going on. But at the end of the day, it will not be enough for them, because Western, let's say, media have a role as well, is to tell their people what's really going on, to tell their people that what's going on is Israeli aggression, Israeli military occupation. Palestinians are not living normal life here in the occupied territories. Palestinians are not terrorists. When a Palestinian is being killed at the checkpoints or near Israeli settlements, they have to tell the truth that in many cases, Palestinians were shot dead in cold blood just because the Israeli soldiers had been standing or near the illegal settlements or at the checkpoints, and they thought those Palestinians were suspicious for the Israeli soldiers. That's why they were killed. And then the Israelis tried to tell the world that this Palestinian or another had a knife, and they tried to attack the Israeli soldiers. So journalists have a very important role to tell the truth, to expose the Israeli lies, of course, and to speak to the international world and to the Western countries to tell the truth that Palestinians are living under occupation and the Israelis continue to speak to the world.
I just wanted to ask David one brief question. You talked about how journalists have been incarcerated. We know that you know, many Palestinians and journalists are routinely incarcerated. There's kind of mass incarceration. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, you know, it's quite shocking, isn't it?
Of course, it's shocking. It's one of the many shocking things. So, as has been said, you know, more than 50 journalists killed in the last 20 years. And the stunning numbers of journalists in prison for incitement, for things like posting on Facebook or on Twitter. And that's a mechanism which is used against Palestinian citizens in general, and indeed also against journalists. Posting on Facebook support for opposition to Zionism, or indeed just poetry, which isn't consonant with Zionist views. So there's a huge attempt to try and to squelch the possibility of the expression of opposition to Zionism.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid, again, we've run out of time, sadly, so we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you very much indeed for joining us. And we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanahu. والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
The world is not empty of two states. Whatever action man does, its relation goes from the heart to the soul, or then the movements of the body parts of and organs. He is not voiding or invalid of these two states. Both its direction is toward the right path and toward Allah or toward Satan, who is against Allah and the right path. Keep up on the right path. Chapter Al-Hamd, verse 6. The path of those upon whom thou hast bestowed favors. Chapter Al-Hamd, verse 7.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, he said that, "Try to hand down the dear Islam which today is in your hands to your descendants in good form. Do not make a crooked form such that they would say that this Islam is such. Islam is luminous." Now, in this part of his speech, he is talking about the reality that if we are not practicing Islam in its true way, then obviously we will not hand over this Islam to our descendants, or we cannot teach them the true practices of Islam. If we do not know about the Islam, we cannot teach our kids. And unfortunately, especially those who are living in the West and nowadays in the East as well, the parents are illiterate in the sense that they do not know about the teachings of Islam. I'm not saying illiterate, which means that they do not know how to read and write. Maybe there is a person who is a doctor. Maybe there is a person who is an engineer. There is a manager. There is a person who is running the whole bank. There is a person who is dealing with the people on the daily basis. And he knows to do what he wants. But on the other hand, when their kids are coming back from the school and when they ask them that, "Oh, daddy or mommy, what is this and why Islam is this?" Or maybe about the God, the existence of God, when they ask, people do not know. They do not know what to answer. And that is the problem. The problem is that we are lacking in observing the teachings of Islam. We are lacking in practicing Islam. We are lacking the knowledge of Islam. And therefore, we are unable to hand over this Islam to our kids. And that's why we see that some people, their families, their kids are becoming atheist or they're converting. Why? It is because of the parents. It's not because of the kids. It is not because of the society. Yes, society does have an impact. That's why he has become an atheist. But on top of that, the major problem is that the parents were not educated well. The parents did not have the education of Islam. They never knew why they are practicing. And this is what Imam Khomeini is also saying. He says, try to hand down the dear Islam, which today is in your hands, to your descendants in good form. Means that educate them, tell them, and practice Islam in the best way so that when they see you, they follow you. Because for the kids, the first role model is their parents. So if we are truly accepting Islam, if we are truly following the teachings of Islam, our kids will also do that.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إلا الله. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. A study by Kelton Miner at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark analysed sleep and outdoor weather data collected from 2015 to 2017 and found that higher world temperatures reduce sleep by delaying its onset. People's bodies need to cool every night as they fall asleep, but this is harder when it is warmer. We now present you an article written by Damien Carrington. The piece is titled, Study Finds Global Heating is Cutting Sleep Across the World. The largest study to date has found rising temperatures driven by the climate crisis are cutting the sleep of people across the world. Good sleep is critical to health and well-being. But global heating is increasing nighttime temperatures even faster than in the daytime, making it harder to sleep at night. The analysis revealed that the average global citizen is already losing 44 hours of sleep a year, leading to 11 nights with less than 7 hours sleep, a standard benchmark of sufficient sleep. Lost sleep will increase further as the planet continues to heat, but it affects some groups much more than others. The sleep loss per degree of warming is about a quarter higher for women than men, twice as high for those over the age of 65, and three times higher for those in less affluent nations. The researchers used data from sleep tracking wristbands used by 47,000 people over 7 million nights and across 68 countries. Previous studies have shown that rising temperatures damage health, including increased heart attacks, increased suicides and mental health crises, and accidents and injuries, as well as reducing the ability to work. Poor sleep has also been shown to have these effects, and the researchers said their study suggests that disturbed sleep may be a key mechanism by which heat causes these health impacts. Worryingly, the researchers said their data showed no sign of people being able to adapt to hotter nights. Kelton Miner at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, who led the new research, said, For most of us, sleep is a familiar part of our daily routine. We spent nearly a third of our lives asleep. Kelton Miner added, But growing numbers of people in many countries across the world do not sleep enough. He said, In this new study, we provide the first planetary scale evidence that warmer than average temperatures erode human sleep. It might actually be the tip of the iceberg because it's very likely our estimates are conservative. Kelton Miner from the University of Copenhagen said sleep reduced by warmer nights is affecting huge numbers of people. For example, he said, a night above 25 degrees Celsius in a city of 1 million people would result in 46,000 extra people suffering from shorter sleep. Kelton Miner said, and if you look at the heat wave that's transpiring right now in India and Pakistan, we're talking about billions of individuals exposed to conditions expected to result in considerable sleep loss. The new study, published in the journal One Earth, analyzed sleep and outdoor weather data collected from 2015 to 2017 and found that higher temperatures reduce sleep by delaying its onset. People's bodies need to cool down every night as they fall asleep, but this is harder to do when it is warmer. Women may be affected more because their bodies usually cool faster than men's when going to sleep. Women also have higher levels of subcutaneous fat on average, making cooling slower. Older people are known to sleep less at night and have poorer body temperature regulation, which may explain their susceptibility. People in poorer nations could lose more sleep as they have less access to cooling features such as window shutters, fans and air conditioning. Researchers at the University of Copenhagen found the impact of warmer nights on sleep was seen in all countries, whether they had naturally cooler or warmer climates, with the impact clear when nighttime temperatures rose above 10 degrees Celsius. Kelton Miner said, "Worryingly, we also found evidence that people already living in warmer climates experience greater sleep erosion per degree of temperature rise." He added, "We had expected those individuals to be better adapted. Furthermore, according to the data, people did not catch up on missed sleep at later times." Kelton Miner said the research had important implications for policymakers, who needed to ensure cities, towns and buildings were well adapted to heat in order to reduce the health impact of rising global temperatures. The British government's official advisers warned in 2021 that it was failing to protect people from the fast-rising risks of the climate crisis, particularly heat waves. The data used in the new study came mainly from richer nations, although it included some data from India, China, Colombia, and South Africa. The wristbands also tended to be worn by people less prone to sleep disturbance by warmer temperatures, such as middle-aged, wealthier men. Kelton Miner said, "Lower-income people are underrepresented in the data, and we're very transparent about that." He said further research was needed, particularly in places that already ranked as among the hottest in the world, such as large parts of Africa, Central America, and West Asia. The research was unable to assess sleep quality, such as the different phases of sleep, but there was no change in the number of times people woke up in the night. Kelton Miner said the path the world chose in terms of how hot the planet got would have consequences for everyone's sleep, adding, "Our decisions collectively as societies will have costs in terms of sleep."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio today our speaker, Sister Razia Batul Najafi. She's an Islamic researcher, and I have had this pleasure to sit with her in the studio today. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
I hope you're doing good. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, sister. We discussed about the responsibilities of parents towards their children. You said the most important responsibilities are giving a good name, giving a better education. As you rightly mentioned, Imam Ali alayhi salam also says that education not only means the secular education, teach your children Quran. So we also said being friends with your children. And regarding that, we had an audience question that I would like to read over here for you. I am 18-year-old boy, and my parents often compare me with other people in society who qualify some state-level exams. This comparison breaks me down inside. I feel like I'm not able to even explore my talent this way. How can I make my parents understand my situation? Is there any way out for my problem in Islam? This is a very beautiful question. It's from the youth itself who is saying that, who is trying to be friends with his parents, but now he's trying to find out a way. So how can we guide actually youth to be friends with their parents?
Beautiful. I think most of our society is suffering from this disease of comparing each other, and I don't know, the way we are not satisfied with, you know, our children's status. Allah tabaraka ta'ala has given to me, for example, two boys or three girls or whatever they do, I have to be, you know, joyful with them and I have to be thankful to Allah. But sometimes our parents, unfortunately, they are comparing a lot, especially when it comes to education, yeah, and to marking high and to some achievements. So that means, unfortunately, they don't have Allah practically in their life. They want to live for society.
All right.
Yeah, they are constantly in the pressure of societies and norms and customs. So Allah wants us to live a free life, beautiful life, you know, with just enjoy. The way our Prophet, he said, just kiss, aksiru min qublati awladikum. Frequently kiss, hug, and smell your child. And enjoy, you know.
Right.
So ulama, the way, you know, some scholars, they say very beautifully that, you know, all this halal, not only halal, also it's our mustahab, recommended stuff. If you do which are joyful, you are just elevating your daraja towards Allah tabarak wa ta'ala. So that is our choice, unfortunately, that because of lack of connection to Allah tabarak wa ta'ala, we are putting that pressure on our teenagers and children, yeah? So I would say that I think we have to, first of all, we have to know that where we are, and min ain fi ain ila ain, you know, why we are in this dunya. I'm here to fulfill my duties according to my capacity. That's it.
All right.
And Allah is not going to ask me and compare me with someone. So how come my parents are comparing me with someone, you know?
All right.
So that is something very unfair and injustice.
All right.
Yeah.
So you said that the problem that lies is the comparison when society, when parents start comparing their kids with others,
yeah,
who are some doing something good at the society level. Well, you said that comparison is not good because that makes them ignorant about the blessings that Allah has given to them or to their kids. Sister Najafi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya Muqiyya Al-Khayrat,
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, avoid reprimanding constantly, for this act provokes the committing of sin and belittles a real reprimanding.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Sister Najafi, we are talking about the responsibilities that parents have towards their kids in Islam. Is there any more responsibility? Like, do you think marriage is one of the responsibilities that parents have in Islam towards their children?
Yeah, I love chapter Noor. And chapter Noor, although whole the book of Allah Tabarak wa Ta'ala is Noor and light, but chapter Noor is especially...
literally Noor.
Yeah, as you know, giving us beautiful Noorani and full of light and dressing and haya, iffat, modesty, chastity. So when it comes to nikah, to marriage, the way Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala talks, that Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَأَنْكِحُ الْأَيَامَ مِنْكُمْ. I love it, the way Allah says, أَنْكِح. أَنْكِح يعني you know, mm-hmm. you, this is your responsibility. So not only parents, أَنْكِحُ means everyone is responsible.
All right.
Yeah. So if I see someone is in late teens or early 20s or mid-20s, you know, whenever, and this is the beauty of Islam. Islam never ever fixed a
particular
age. Number. Yeah, it depends. You know, sometimes I'm so much focused in my studies. I want to do
sometimes
after 2 years.
Sometimes I'm
years.
In 20 exactly. and I'm not mature
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone has a choice. This is a beauty. Beauty, beauty. You know, wow. I love the way Islam is just, you know, giving us so much room to think, to progress. So then, ankihu, if you feel, oh, someone really... you know, needs a partner, so you have to put that step, you know, and you will get for each step, each word, each click, each, you know, whatever you do for making that two yeah, partners yeah, together for that marriage, you will get absolutely a, you know, enormous sawab near Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. But when it comes to parents, no one can, you know, deny that definitely, you know, parents' duty and their responsibility.
It's a kind of obligatory
exactly,
thing for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we are not ignoring the society and friends and other relatives too. So, yeah, unfortunately, again, many cases comes to us that, and they say that, you know, I really want to get married, but my parents are looking for, again, some customs, you know?
All right.
Yeah, the customs, the norms, again, the society's pressure, you know? Oh, yeah. They live in their imaginary rosy world that, oh, I want my girl to wear this and to have that much gold and, you know, that kind of big hall they wanna rent. And nowadays it's not, you know, cheap at all.
Yeah.
So
that sounds really
exactly.
interesting. I'll be talking to you on that note here. We need to take another short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. And I have with me Sister Najafi in the studio, who is talking about Islamic upbringing and the responsibilities of parents towards their children in Islam. Sister Najafi, you said very important is marriage. Every person in the society who thinks two people are in need of each other, whatever the move they make towards getting these couple together, they get tremendous rewards in return. Sister Najafi, you were talking about some customs. What are parents doing?
Yeah, I give some rights, definitely, because of our media. Everyone has some imagination, beautiful, like they say, oh, yeah, I want to have this kind of, you know, marriage ceremony for my son or for my daughter.
Yeah.
But we should be very, very practical. Okay, I know your intention is so pure. You know, you want to be very, very, you know, like very nice towards your children. Therefore, you're thinking of, you know, to spend so much money.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to compare the need of your child, you know, that need, the urge. It's not controllable sometimes, you know, they cannot control it because of, again, nowadays, day by day, it's more challenging.
True.
Challenging, yeah? So in one hand, if you are just delaying the marriage ceremony, just because of some, you are...
To go through some customs and rituals,
yeah, yeah,
and to show a trendy marriage.
Yeah. And in other side is maybe my child is committing some sins, you
all
know?
Right.
Yeah. So which one is heavier? You know, which one is more important? That means a lot. So Allah has made me a parent, you know, a trainer, a person who's guiding this beautiful generation. So how come I'm not thinking wisely about my child's future, you know, my child's eternal life? So when I see, oh, maybe, you know, if you have the doubt, the way, like, we travel to a country where we have a doubt, maybe we will not save in that city or country. We don't go, yeah, so maybe I come back safely, but maybe not. So even if you have a doubt, you have to take a precaution, yeah, and you should just skip and just, you know, like the advice decision for your child's, you know, future. And not only future, not only akhirah, but also here, because, you know, our we can say spiritual need, mental needs is more than our physical need. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I don't need some diamond rings, but I need a good partner.
Really? Yeah.
That is more important, the educated one, the nice one, not a one who can give me a nice, you know, like all facilities or whatever we are
something
looking
materialistic
for.
Yeah,
yeah,
all
yeah,
right.
Unfortunately.
So that was really a very important point you touched over here. You said that marriage is one of the very important responsibilities of parents towards their children. And you said not only parents, even if anyone in the society, in a Muslim society, be that your cousins, be
yeah,
that your brothers,
yeah,
be that anyone, be that your friends,
sometimes,
teachers, whoever feels that you are in need of someone physically, intellectually, and emotionally, and you have a partner. So whatever the move they make towards getting this couple together, they get tremendous rewards in return, you said. Thank you so much, Sister Najafi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. For any suggestions, for any questions, for any feedback, please email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Our website is parstoday.com, wherein you can find all our programs. Going to the option Call of Islam and you'll find our programs. Until another episode, fi amanullah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.